From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor David Morse. Many of us first knew him from his role on St. Elsewhere as the shy, sensitive Dr. Boomer Morrison. Well, lately, Morse is not so shy and sensitive. In June, he opens in the action film The Rock. He was a muscular ex-con in The Crossing Guard, and in 12 Monkeys, well, he was pretty devious. Also today, some thoughts on visual perception from a blind man. Photographer George Covington was born legally blind with less than 10% of normal vision. The world around him is a blur, but he can make out the images and photographs, so he takes pictures of people's faces and the streets he walks through. Covington is also former Special Assistant for Disability Policy to Vice President Dan Quayle. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Der Wolf ist oft gut bei seinen Serbs, sie sehen also, ihr in der jetzt, du bist für erst gestern, jetzt, nein, nein, für andere, die uns nehmen, aber so wie du. Nimm ihr gerne auf, sie sind ein bisschen, das ist nicht über den Nehmen, über die Wiese, die der Serbs, der Ehler, sie hat nicht nur das Sack, aber oh, ihr seht, in der Runde, das Nehmen, das so ist, das ist der Kau, was ist, wenn ihr auf, und der Wolf, so der Lehrer, 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 Well, sure, see, so there were gloves in it, or see, and if you bring off, see, send your cup in it and see your mouth nearest. I think even that dog does hot in the earth, but he had severe stress at North and the earth and him North and the earth. So Sam, but Nick Valerie, he had him. So I reckon I'm sure sending him out, he'll ever see the way it is. There you look at me here. I'm a little bit more full of passion. He said, there's no one to be here for sure. Yes, we are here, guys.
We're raving for stuff, but the lock in is sorry. Yeah, it's nice to throw there's that vessel over gallops and a liver say, and if you see the lights, I say, it's called blood running on the bell in the area of seas, no for stuff. Boy, shit, scanner from out and didn't show me as we know you don't give up lunch and more.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I always like to be surprised by an actor, and David Morris has surprised me a lot lately. I first knew him in his role on St. Elsewhere, the popular TV hospital series of the 80s. Morris played Dr. Jack Boomer Morrison. His character was young, sensitive, constantly wounded by life. Boomer's first wife was killed, his young son was kidnapped, and Boomer was raped by inmates of a prison where he was performing community service. Lately, Morse is not so sensitive. In the film The Crossing Guard, directed by Sean Penn, he played a pumped-up ex-con who did time for killing a young girl in a hit-and-run accident while driving drunk. Her father was played by Jack Nicholson. In 12 Monkeys, Morse played a devious character willing to wreak havoc on the Earth. And in June, he'll co-star with Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery in the prison action film The Rock, set in Alcatraz. It's not just Morse's image that's changed, so has the place he calls home. He told me why he fled L.A. and moved to the East Coast.
Well, I'd grown up on the East Coast. My wife had grown up on the East Coast. And the earthquake brought us here in a hurry. We'd talked about it for a long time. We'd been in Los Angeles for about 12 years. And on the morning of the earthquake, we lost our house, and it was time to leave.
What happened to your house?
Well, the whole foundation was gone. We were on a hillside, and the hillside started to go, and we just couldn't go back to it. It actually was still standing, but it was completely, you know, a wreck inside, and it has to be torn down.
Could you describe what you heard and saw the night of the earthquake?
Well, I was asleep, and I heard it coming in my sleep. We lived on the valley side, and I'd heard them coming before, and truly, it's a terrifying sound. And hearing this thing come across the valley, I was literally out of my bed before I was awake, thinking, I've got to get the kids. And I hit the floor as the earthquake hit the house, and I was thrown to the floor and couldn't get up. And I was just thinking, I've killed my children, we've killed our children, and we've stayed here too long. All I could think is how stupid we were. And finally got to we have twins, and I got to one of them, and I remembered my daughter was sleeping in the bedroom where I was, and my wife was underneath the house in the guest room, and we had a housekeeper who was with us, and I was yelling at her to get a child, and the earthquake is still going on, and the kids are covered in plaster, and it was just a scary event.
The kids must have been terrified.
They actually slept through the whole thing.
They did?
Yeah, except for one. The one I didn't grab, of course, was the one who was awake. And he was the one who remembers it all.
How old is he?
He's 4 now, but he was 2 then.
Was he pretty scared by the whole thing?
Yeah, really scared. And that thing that he really remembered is when we didn't know what happened to Susan, because she had to go outside of the house to get into the house, and we were sitting up there. Every window in the house had blown open, and doors, and the alarm was going off, and it's one of those talking alarms, and this window is open, and that door is open, and there's this futuristic, scary thing, and every buzzer in the house was happening. We didn't know where Susan was, and finally we heard her voice at the front door yelling up to us, and the house was filling up with gas. I could smell the gas going all through the house because the gas line had broken. So we started yelling to each other back and forth about the gas. We got to do something about the gas. And Benjamin remembers that, and he has the image of I don't know how, where it came from, but the explosion, fire, and that's what was probably the scariest part for him.
Did the house actually explode?
No. But he made the connection with gas and fire.
So would you do run outside of the house eventually and just stand and watch for
a while? Well, we didn't know what to do. We'd always heard stay inside. There were aftershocks. And we were all sick. Benjamin had pneumonia. We all were on antibiotics. And we had one of those houses with all the heavy Spanish tile roof. And Susan had kind of run through this falling tile to get back. And then I didn't want to take the kids outside and have to worry about things falling off the roof and not know where to go once we got out there. So we stayed, you know, in doorways for a while we kind of collected blankets and water and our antibiotics and that stuff, and watched literally down from the hill from us, the block was burning down below us, so we could look out the windows and see the fires. And it seemed like the end of the world.
Did you try to save certain prized possessions besides the antibiotics?
Well, people always say to take the pictures. And right then, all we could think of was that the house was standing, and once the sun started coming up, we got everybody in the car and covered them in blankets and stayed there and finally borrowed a cellular phone from somebody and was able to get to people on the other side of Los Angeles, friends, and realized their place was okay, and got out, and we lived with them for a week.
Well, I could see how this would encourage you to leave the city. So were you in the middle of making a movie during the earthquake?
We were just starting The Crossing Guard, literally. We had done one day of shooting.
Didn't Sean Penn, who directed that, lose his house?
And he had just lost
too?
His house. No, he lost it in the fire.
Oh, he lost it in a fire.
Right, and he had just lost that, whatever it was, 6 months before.
Wow, so the director and one of the leads, both out of homes.
Mm.
So did he want to keep going?
Of course. It was the first, actually the first film up and shooting after the earthquake.
So how soon after you lost your home were you on the set?
2 days later, or the day later, the next morning, actually.
Boy, you know, you never know what's going through somebody's mind when they're making a movie. Mm-hmm. I saw you in The Crossing Guard, and I thought, gee, what a really life-changing performance this is, because I'd never seen you in that kind of role before where you misunderstand the character's motives in the beginning and think that the character's really a bad guy and a real tough guy. And as the film goes on, you see that he's really kind of much more sensitive than that. But, you know, you physically transformed yourself for the role.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, hey, lucky guy, you know, good break. And while you were making the movie, it must have been horrible.
Well, yeah. I mean, our life certainly was, you know,
in turmoil.
And really in turmoil.
Yeah. Now, you did transform yourself for The Crossing Guard. Or at least you looked really different to me. You put on a lot of muscles.
A lot of weight, yeah.
Was part of it just weight and part of it muscle, too?
It was a lot of food and a lot of working out. It was a lot of muscle. Sean and I, one of the nice things about working with Sean is I've done two films with him now, and he has really included me in the whole process of the character and developing the script and, you know, talking about the script and all of that. And it's really been two of the greatest acting experiences of my life. And I'd known about this character for a long time. Actually, right after we finished The Indian Runner, he showed me just a scene. It was a scene where Jack's character and my character get together for the first time. And he asked me what I thought, and I thought, this is a great scene. And out of that came, you know, eventually came a script. So I'd been involved for a long time. And we had talked about this character in so many different ways. And finally, we just came to, it's a man who has survived 6 years in prison, and you don't survive it for no reason. He was transformed by prison in a lot of ways. And part of that is you got nothing to do but eat bad food and work out. So that's essentially what I did for 3 months.
Let me get back to your physical transformation for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Did it change your personality for a while as your body started to change? Did you carry yourself differently or feel different?
Oh, really different. Feel really different. Yeah. And not just because of the size of my body, but also, you know, the facial hair and what we had done. I'd straightened my hair and darkened it. We'd done all that, and we're playing with all of that. And it's a very different impression when you walk into a room and you're that size and you're that, and you stand next to people. It's not what, first of all, people are familiar with me from you know, obviously from St. Elsewhere and other work I've done.
Where you were a very sensitive guy, not right. A physically threatening character.
Right, right. And there's all, you know, so there's obvious surprise of people not expecting who they expect to see when I walk into the room, but also what I look like. And there's something actually kind of powerful about that. I kind of liked it.
Yeah. So what kind of reactions would you get to your imposing physical presence?
Being outright startled. Actually, one of the first houses when my wife came back east, she was hopping around from house to house, and I got to visit them for a weekend, and the person that they were staying in the house had never met me before. And I had spent the night, woke up in the morning. He came home and walked around the corner and saw me in the doorway and thought he was being robbed and thought he was in physical danger. And I could just see it all over him. He didn't know whether to bolt from the house or what.
And you liked it.
I did like it.
Now, you worked with Jack Nicholson in The Crossing Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And were you at all uncomfortable about sharing scenes with him, afraid that he'd be like such a strong presence that it would be hard to hold your own?
No, I don't think I don't really have that concern. And also, Jack doesn't let you have that. I had met him before we started shooting, and he doesn't let you have that feeling just in relationship in person with him. And he doesn't let you have that feeling on the set. He doesn't let anybody have that feeling. He doesn't let the crew have that feeling. You always have the awareness that he's a superstar, and you can tell that he enjoys that. But he's very human, and he's really there to make the best film he can make and make the best scene he can make.
No, you strike me as very different from Sean Penn. Sean Penn mm-hmm. has a reputation of being a very combustible kind of character, and you seem like a very reserved, quiet
mm-hmm.
person, probably mm-hmm. someone who, I don't know if I should say you wouldn't be easily rattled. I have no idea if you'd be easily rattled or not, but you probably wouldn't blow up or...
Oh, it takes me a long time to blow up, and when I do, it's pretty major. I just hold on to things for a long time.
Right.
I think that's maybe part of the fun with working with Sean, is he actually encourages certain qualities in me that other people don't.
Which qualities?
Well, taking this character, going to new places with this character, that a lot of times when I get a job, people hire me because of exactly who I am. I may be interested in doing something different with the character, but that's not what they're interested in. And that can be very discouraging, because that's a lot of what I find interesting in acting, is taking myself to emotional, mostly new places, physically new places, whatever it is. And Sean, as an actor, does that. And as a director, he enjoys that and brings that out.
What made him think that if you, ate and exercised for quite a while, that you could transform yourself in such a way as to be perfect for this character who had spent 6 years in prison after killing Nicholson's son in a car accident?
I don't know. I think
or daughter, excuse
well,
me.
He's been through it himself, and things
in
like
transforming
close range,
himself, yeah.
And I think he's aware of what it did to himself when he went through that process.
Mm-hmm.
He obviously goes to extremes, and he knows what that will bring out in an actor.
My guest is David Morse. He starred in The Crossing Guard, and this June he opens in the action film The Rock. In the 80s, he played Dr. Jack Boomer Morrison on St. Elsewhere. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor David Morse.
If somebody doesn't know you, especially like before you had a real track record, if you show up for an audition and you walked in as yourself, kind of quiet, reserved guy, small voice,
right?
Would they think that you had it in you to be something different from that?
Of course not. No. And I've had to fight that for a long time. That was one of the problems with doing St. Elsewhere, is people thought they knew who I was. They thought they knew what I could do. And I was defined by that role for a long time.
And that role was, you know, sensitive doctor, sensitive husband, sensitive widower, sensitive new husband. And, but you were always very reserved and sensitive.
And not always very interested in doing that, but that was, you know, that was the role and that was my job to do, and I, you know, did as best I could.
What did you think the best and worst parts of being in a weekly series for 6 years were?
Well, this series in particular, I think it was probably one of the most extraordinary series that's been on television. I don't think I'm, you know, alone in feeling that way. So to be a part of something like that, it was great, but I think I'll, in some ways it was hard because it's like looking at a family that looks really good from the outside, but nobody sees the dysfunctional part inside, and you don't really want to talk about the dysfunctional part. You don't want to betray everybody by what's, you know, what's going on. So you kind of, you know, keep the good face and keep, you know, all of that. And meantime, you know, it has its own set of problems within.
What did you do when the series ended? What was like your first move after that, to try to establish a new acting life?
I don't. I was actually offered a quite a number of series after St. Elsewhere went off the air, which I just think it was normal for a lot of people to go off a series, and I felt so cemented in television at that point. It's pretty much all I'd done for. Whatever it was, 7 years at that point. And I knew that I wanted to be able to do some films, and I wanted to be able to do theater. And I knew if I just kept doing series, I would never get out of it. And there are very good things about doing a series, but there are also the drawbacks of being locked into that character. And also locked into people thinking you're a television actor. And it's not what I valued about my work and my identity. So I needed to make that break. And I pretty much was willing to do whatever role I could get in a certain way in film.
What kind of roles did you get after St. Elsewhere?
Well, the first film I did after St. Elsewhere was a film called Desperate Hours with Mickey Rourke and Anthony Hopkins, who hadn't done a film in quite a while in this country. And he was great to work. He was so grateful to be working in film. He loves films. So I did a role in that, which is pretty wild character. And I actually got Indian Runner right after that. Sean saw Desperate Hours, and he remembered me from a film. The very first film I did was called Inside Moves. And he asked me to come in. I didn't know him. And I knew his father, Leo, who had directed on St. Elsewhere, and his brother, Michael, who had done background work on St. Elsewhere. And he asked me if I'd just come in and talk to him about Indian Runner. And he, for some reason, got it in his head that I should be the guy in it, even though everybody said that all these huge stars should be doing the role. And he said, no, this is the guy who should be doing it. And he fought for me all the way down the line.
Wow, that's probably a rare thing.
Really a rare thing.
That's very nice.
Yeah.
What's it like for you to live in a regular East Coast city as opposed to in the capital of the entertainment business where, you know, people are running into actors and actresses and directors pretty regularly?
Right. Well, your whole life, everything is about work there. Everything is about career. Every relationship, every time you go to dinner, every automobile you buy, everything... Every decision you make seems to revolve around the business, your work you do. And I just felt dead in a lot of ways. I had enjoyed doing a lot of things before I went out there. And a lot of those things just didn't happen. And when I came back here, I felt this whole thing lifted off me, and I felt much more creative and open. I just feel much better about myself back here.
You know, we talked about how for so long your image as an actor was as, you know, a kind of sensitive, introspective guy, and how you've really changed that. I mean, in fact, your next movie is an action film.
Right.
The Rock, which is, it's not exactly Escape from Alcatraz. I mean, Alcatraz, I've seen the trailers a half dozen times already. Alcatraz, right?
Yeah, it is. I've already done an Escape from Alcatraz.
Oh, you already seen that one.
My second time out there. Yeah, this one is they're trying to get into Alcatraz.
Right, because what's the premise? Alcatraz is already a state park, and they want to like hold it hostage or something.
It's a group of Marines who have taken over the island, and they're kind of holding San Francisco hostage, and they need to find somebody who can get back onto the island. And the only person who's ever escaped from it, who nobody wants to admit has ever escaped, they track him down, and that's Sean Connery. And he's the guy who's going to get him back in there.
What I imagine is nice for somebody like you doing an action film is, A, you could probably really have a sense of irony about it when you need to, and B, it's too late for you to worry about getting typecast as an action star. I mean, you already have a whole career behind you. So you can do it without worrying about getting stuck in that for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And then outgrowing it.
Right. Well, I think the only thing I have to worry about at the moment is I'm afraid I'm to have done kind of a series of bad guys. And I kind of got locked into the nice guy for so long, and I'm afraid now I'm going to get locked into the bad guy. It seems very easy for people to get a certain idea about you in their heads, and that's the only thing I'm really concerned about.
Okay. So what else are you coming out in that we should watch for?
Another action film, which is called The Long Kiss Goodnight, which Rennie Harlan is directing with Gina Davis and Sam Jackson.
Bad guy.
And a film called Extreme Measures that Michael Apted is directing, and Hugh Grant and Elizabeth Hurley are producing. Bad guy. And that one, too.
People react to you differently when you play the bad guy than when you play the sensitivo?
Well, there's a lot of people. A lot of my mother's friends who want me to be the good guy. They all miss me being a good guy. And my mother does, too, I think. But I don't know if people on the street react very differently.
David Morse, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Actor David Morse, his next film, The Rock, opens in June. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dow Jones Business News and Information Services, featuring Dow Jones News Retrieval, an online service where business finds answers. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Twenty years ago, when George Covington's already impaired sight began to degenerate, he found some compensation in a camera. Coming up, we talk with Covington about using photography to see and about his work as an activist. Covington is an attorney and former special assistant for disability policy to Vice President Dan Quayle. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It sounds like a gimmick, a blind photographer, but it's not. And this photographer has some pretty interesting insights about visual perception. George Covington was born legally blind. He has some very limited sight. The world around him is a blur. But when images are reduced and focused in a photograph, he can see faces, buildings, streets, all sorts of things that he could never perceive in real life. That's why he takes pictures. The pictures enable him to see. Covington also has strong opinions about design and access for the disabled. He's the co-author of the forthcoming book, Access by Design. Covington served as Special Assistant for Disability Policy to Vice President Dan Quayle. He was recently profiled in the public television series People in Motion. I asked him why it's easier for him to make sense of a two-dimensional photograph than it is to see the world.
Okay, let's take a scene. I usually shoot portraits, but it's applicable to both portraits and scenes. If I get close enough to see a wooded area, I'm going to see the bark of a tree, and that's all. I'm literally a foot from the tree or a few inches from the tree, depending on the lighting. If I back up to take a look at that forest or that scene, I lose the detail that I need to comprehend what it is I'm seeing, and I simply see a large blur. And I've used this for years in the context of museum accessibility. If I try to see Rembrandt's The Night Watch, I'm going to be only a few inches from it. And all I'm seeing is a few inches on either side of my nose. If I back up to see the whole scene, I've lost the details, so therefore I've lost comprehension of what the whole painting is. If I photograph it, let's say 11 by 17 inch black and white or even color, I can move that around in my best field of vision under the best lighting conditions, and I can tell you everything in that painting.
Now, when you are looking at a photograph, do you need the photograph enlarged?
Only for the last few years, the last 3 years to be exact, the macula in my eye began to degenerate. Although I was born legally blind with nystagmus, astigmatism, eccentric fixation, acute myopia, they never understood why it wasn't optically correctable. Between journalism and law school, it was discovered finally that I had macular degeneration. There was no place for the image to focus on the back of the eye. And so only within the last 3 years have I had to use preferably a 4x6 or an 8x10, and only within the last 3 years have I had to use a magnifying lens to see with. Before that, I could, even as limited as my vision was, I could see a photograph.
So when you meet somebody, are you likely to take a picture of them so that you know what they look like?
Yes. I have on me today two different cameras. One is I always keep with me, which is a small point-and-shoot, one of the best point-and-shoots they make, but it fits comfortably in a coat pocket or in a shirt pocket, and I use it like a pair of glasses. When I meet somebody, I photograph them. I try to have that film processed within a week because if I've never seen your image before and I can't identify the background, then I don't know who it was I photographed. And it's very embarrassing at the end of the year to have several hundred pictures that you haven't been able to give to people because I always have two prints made, one for myself and one for the individual.
Now, how do you know where to aim the camera?
Basically, there are times when I miss. I try to have them in a situation that I can control, such as against a white wall, which is also a problem because then I can't identify them because there's so many white walls. But in a lighting situation where I can frame and I have just 5% vision on the peripheral of the right eye and under proper lighting conditions, I can see to frame and the camera does everything else.
Before your eyes degenerated, how much could you see? What's the height of your...
When I was born with approximately 10% normal vision, mm-hmm. but it was overall. There was no peripheral loss at that time. I functioned as a sighted person. I was legally blind, yes, but I did not use a cane or a dog. I was mobile throughout society. I had trouble reading signs, and I couldn't read the names on buses and things of that nature. But I was able to get around. And many people did not know I had a visual impairment until they saw me trying to read something. And then I would hold it right literally to my nose to read normal text. And I lost the ability to read normal text without magnification in law school.
My guest, George Covington, is legally blind, but he's a photographer and uses the photographs to see things in two dimensions that he'd have trouble seeing in three dimensions in the actual world. George, how did you start taking pictures?
It started when I was in law school, and I started dating a young woman who was doing postgraduate work and just beginning to learn photography. And I'd always wanted to learn photography, and I really didn't understand at that time why I was fascinated by photo magazines, why I was fascinated by Newsweek, Time, and Life and Look, and so forth. And even as a child, I would look at these magazines on newsstands, and I didn't understand what it was that I was getting out of them. And at the same time, I found a camera that I could focus. It was an old scale model Rolly. And she and I would traipse around Central Texas carrying her 4x5 camera and this old wooden camera in an old wooden box with an old wooden tripod, and it weighed a ton. And one day, and this is what really got me started, we were out and she was doing her art rock shots and her stump shots and her beautiful stream shots. And I would stand there for an hour while she set up the camera, while she focused, while she got it just framed right, and while she took a picture. When we got back to the darkroom and processed those four by five negatives, I discovered that I hadn't seen what she had been doing. My imagination and memory had put together things that were not there, and that's what really startled me, because what I had thought for an hour she was photographing a rock, it turned out to be a stump, or what I thought was a stump turned out to be a bush. And I realized that I had been within 5 or 6 feet of what she was doing, and it really startled me. So I started photographing, like walking from my apartment to law school through a park, and suddenly I saw a waist-high boulder that was only a few feet off the trail. And once I knew it was there, I saw it every day. But I had been walking that trail for several years and had never seen that waist-high boulder. And then I suddenly realized that photographing across a street, I could see signs that I couldn't see standing under them on their side of the street.
Now, I think this was about 20 years ago that you started taking pictures?
A little over, about 23, 24 years ago that I started.
And this coincided with a period when you knew you were losing eyesight.
Exactly.
How did you prepare for the loss that you knew was coming?
I got a law degree so that I could get a law license and be a plumber. That's basically it. I never really intended to practice law. I just wanted a law degree and a law license because there's so many things you can do in our society with that. And I took it to Washington for almost 20 years. And so that's about the only way. I started looking at the services that were available. I started looking at the aids and devices as they came online. And I began to realize there were a lot of things out there that I could use that would help compensate for my failing vision.
Like what?
Cassettes that are available through the National Library Service, Division of the Blind and Physically Handicapped. They've got over, I think, 50,000 titles now in every field that you could possibly be interested in, including a manual that I did approximately 12 years ago called Let Your Camera Do the Seeing, which is the first photography manual for the legally blind, and that's available. And modern novels, everything you can conceive of, plus Recordings for the Blind, which primarily records textbooks for students and people to use in their businesses and so forth. There are so many services out there that people just aren't aware of, and that is a shame.
When you knew that you were losing the sight that you had, did you start to develop little tricks to help you get around?
Yes, for the first, I would say, until 7 or 8 years ago, when I started traveling with a cane, because most airports are laid out by schizophrenics with a warped sense of humor, I would do things like walk up to the counter and say, excuse me, I lost my contact lenses. Can you tell me, you know, which gate flight so-and-so is on? And I remember, and this has happened to every blind person I know. One day I was traveling with the young woman that I learned photography with, and I walked up to a counter in Palm Beach, and I said, when's the flight to Washington? And she said, it's on the monitor up here. And for some reason, instead of doing the old, I lost my contacts at a party last night, I said, I'm legally blind. And she turned to the companion and said, tell him 4 o'clock. And I said, tell her I'm legally blind, not legally deaf. And as I say, that story, I think every blind person I've ever met has that story to tell.
Now, you use a white cane now.
Yes.
Do you use a dog?
No, the cane doesn't have to be walked 3 times a day. And I can't get attached to it when it breaks.
Now, what are the advantages of the cane and what are its limitations?
Basically, it is a stick of myth. It can frighten people, but it also can alert them. Before I used it, I could be standing under a large sign saying, excuse me, where is the Sears? Or where is Gate 3? And these people would look up and see this 2-foot-high sign above my head and go, he's one of them. He's escaped from someplace. And so consequently, the white cane does alert people. But there are a lot of people who are really frightened of it and are frightened of using it because they do not want the negative images, the myths, and the stereotypes applied to them. And I don't blame them.
Now, do you use the white cane mostly because it's a symbol that you're legally blind and you'll get the assistance that you need, or do you use it also to feel your way around?
I feel my way around with it. I have no depth perception. So a curb can be 4 inches, or it can be 12 or 15 inches, or a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently, I have trouble with shadows. At night, I could not be mobile at all without the white cane. And also, too, people wearing beige outfits standing on a beige street corner, I can ram right into them without the cane. And at least they know I'm not drunk or abusive when I do sort of touch them with the cane and they leap into the air and move on.
If you're just joining us, my guest, George Covington, is legally blind. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with George Covington. He's legally blind, but he has some sight. He used to have more sight. He has a degenerative eye problem. And the things that he can see in the real world, he uses a camera to see. He takes pictures of it, and the picture reduces the size of the image, and it's much more manageable for him to see that. George Covington, you're also an activist. How did you become an activist in the area of disabilities?
Basically, by default, I've basically stood up for my own rights for many years. I used to say that growing up in the South, I never thought I'd have to fight for my civil rights. And as I became blinder and blinder, and it became more obvious that I was, then I started to see the way other people were treated, other people with minorities. And so consequently, in 1979, I went to work for the Department of the Interior, writing what was then called the Section 504 regs, which were the first attempt by the federal government really to guarantee our civil rights, and that was wording very similar to the Civil Rights Act of 64. Initially, it applied only to those who received federal financial assistance, and then later it applied to all the executive branches of the government. And so working on those regs, I began to see the world of the disabled because I had never considered myself disabled. I could get around without a cane or a dog. My interests were in reading, going to the theater, appreciating the arts. I wasn't interested in rallies. And to a large extent now, I restrict my speeches and lectures to the able-bodied because too many of us with disabilities seem to like to sing to the chorus. And I would rather go around and try to convince designers that if they would design the world better, they would have less excuse to call us the disabled and lump us all together as one amorphous mass.
You know, in the PBS series People in Motion, which you profiled, there's a clip of you talking to people who design access to museum shows.
Right. They were basically exhibit designers.
Exhibit designers. Okay. And you were pretty insulting to them, I thought. You basically said, look, you know, I don't want to just see like this like artsy entranceway. I want something that I could actually enter. You know, I don't care about your artistic pretensions. All I want is to be able to, like, get around and have access to this.
Basically, there were two things that I said, and you only got to hear one of them because we did 12 hours of filming and reduced it to 14 minutes, I believe. But I always say there's two things you've got to understand about disability. The first one is we can lie, cheat, and steal, be fools, fakes, and frauds, just like everybody else. Too often, we're treated like children, and that's where we have problems with civil rights. People don't want to assume that we can take the responsible role of citizens in this country. And you've got to accept that we can be saints or we can be sinners, just like everybody else. The second one is, and probably the most dangerous, is that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. We have seen disasters, billions of dollars go down the tube by people who really wanted to do good by us poor disabled people. And what I was explaining before I viciously went after that woman was that you've got to be able to have the skills and the tools and know what you're doing and communicate with us. And too often, and I've worked with museums for more than 20 years, Too often, the museum designers are frustrated artists who can't make it as artists, so they're going to make it by making a statement on somebody else's work. And when they do that, they layer. And too often, that layer is an artistic statement. And the best example is a museum in Washington that will remain anonymous that used to love to put mauve on mauve for their signage. And I knew sighted people who couldn't read it. And what I was trying to explain was, and what I said, you can make an artistic statement as long as you communicate. That's what you're supposed to be doing, making the exhibits of other artists accessible to us and giving us access to our culture. But that didn't quite make it onto the screen.
Right. You're active in the area of design. In fact, you have a forthcoming book on universal design. What is universal design?
Universal design is a concept that started in the 20s in Holland and Germany. And basically the concept was you can design something that will maximize its uses across a very broad spectrum. And what I say in the book is if you can design a product, a place, or a service so that an 8-year-old child or an 80-year-old adult can use it, many of us disabled people will fit on that continuum. Not all of us, but many of us. And if there needs to be alterations, they're less costly if you have this concept of universal design. The best example is replacing a doorknob with a lever. The doorknob was invented to push and pull. It was never invented to turn. But unfortunately, it was round, and clockmakers were able to build mechanisms that would make it open and close inside the castle rather than outside the castle walls. And so consequently, it's lasted much longer than it should have. Where a lever, if you're carrying 2 bags of groceries, you can use your elbow. If you're carrying an infant and a bag of groceries or an infant and pushing a stroller, you can open that door easy. But that's just one example. Making controls on consumer goods more accessible to visually impaired people. Things of that nature.
Would a lever be any better for you than a doorknob as someone who is legally blind?
It would be if I was carrying something. But see, that's the whole thing. It's supposed to be seamless. It's not supposed to identify us. One of the examples I use is that if I'm walking down the street and my intern at WNET here in New York, who is in a wheelchair, tries to follow me onto the sidewalk and there's no curb cut, suddenly he's defined as disabled by our society because there's no curb cut there. Too often it's the design of society that allows us to be called the disabled. You know, it's not our fault that people don't understand that ramps are a lot easier to use than stairs and were invented thousands of years before steps.
What else helps you that you think would also be of help to sighted people?
To give you an example, the controls on microwaves, the controls on washers and dryers, if they were designed in such a way that more people could see them, more people could use them. Because if we design a home with appliances that are accessible, people in that home will be able to live there longer and not have to go to nursing homes because they've lost their independence, because they simply can't see quite as well or move quite as fast. People don't understand that when you're 50 years old, a third less light is hitting the back of your eye than when you were 20. But most people don't change the lighting in their offices or their home, and they wonder why they're stumbling over things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this reminds me of a point that I know you often make, which is that you think aging baby boomers will be the allies of the disabled.
I think they will for one very simple reason. As they hit the brick wall of 50 and more than, I think, 3.4 million are this year alone, then they're going to want convenience. And we can sell them universal design as convenience. And when they buy it, we'll be able to buy it too. They're the richest market out there. And so if we combine them with the aging market that's already there, those over 65 who have disposable incomes, with the baby boomers who are going to demand their rights, they've always had them, they expect to have them. And if they don't hear quite as well or see quite as well or move quite as fast, they're going to want those appliances to be easier to use, and we'll be able to come in right behind them.
Can you think of another example of universal design that you think would help aging baby boomers or, you know, anyone who's older and help disabled people at the same time?
Accessible bathrooms and accessible kitchens. Making kitchen counters, for instance, have contrast edges so that other people can see where the edge is, so that you don't inadvertently put something too close to the edge. The bathroom is probably the most dangerous place in the house because it hasn't basically been redesigned since World War II. And an example of that is, why do bathtubs have to be made out of completely rigid and solid materials? They can be made out of softer, you know, plastics that would hold the heat or the cold longer. And showers can be arranged in such a way that other people can handle them. People who have eye-hand control problems as they get older can use a redesigned bathroom that has a sink that can be raised or lowered. There's almost no aspect of life that can't be better designed with better products and better places.
Gee, I never thought of a bathroom that way, but you know how true it hasn't.
It hasn't changed since World War II.
It has not changed. Yeah.
And the problem, what people don't seem to understand, is right after World War II, we had a material shortage, so consequently, bathrooms were built small. And you can see when you see the houses of the rich and famous. I mean, their bathrooms are the size of the rest of ours bedrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the average house built today, just for the us middle class folks, is still the same bathroom from World War II. And there's absolutely no reason for it to be.
God forbid you want to fit the kitty litter in the bathroom, you're really in trouble.
Well, as a friend of mine put it, who has like six kids, try to bathe three of them in a bathtub at the same time without hitting your head on the sink.
My guest is George Covington. He's a legally blind photographer and an activist on disability issues. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. George Covington is my guest. Now, you're legally blind. You have less sight now than you did when you were young because your eye disease is degenerative. Did you go to any special schools when you were young?
No, I went to Grimm Elementary. People don't believe that, but it's actually called Grimm Elementary. My first grade teacher was named Miss Steele. I got a paddling the first day of the first grade and three ping pong paddles broken on my little butt in the first grade. I like to talk. And every year they would send a note home to my mother saying, why don't you send the little half-blind kid down to the school for the blind? And that's how I was referred to, as the little half-blind kid, because I was such a terror in class. And one day Miss Steele called me to the front of the room for the ultimate humiliation. She said, if you've got something to say, say it to the whole class. And about 45 minutes later, she realized she'd made a really bad mistake.
What did you say?
I just started telling stories. I had my first captive audience. I loved it.
Uh-huh.
So I went on, and finally she said, go back to your seat. And so whenever things would get really tough, and her class was made up mostly of us kids from the projects, then she would just call me to the front of the class and say, tell them a story. And then toward the end of the first grade, now this is a 7-year-old kid, she calls me up to the front of her desk, and I wasn't talking that day. I must have been ill or something. And I said, I didn't do anything. And she said, just looked at me and said, Covington, if you ever earn an honest dollar in your life, it'll be as a writer. Go back to your seat. So that's basically what I got out of the first grade.
Well, it's not bad advice.
Bad advice at all.
Usually people are urged not to be writers because there's not a lot of money in it.
It could have been a vengeful thing that she did, but I don't think so.
Uh-huh. Since your eye problem is degenerative, are you planning to, are you preparing to lose what eyesight you have left?
Not any more so than I have done in the last couple of years. Science has been wrong about the length of time. I was told more than 24 years ago that it would be 5 to 6 years, or it might be 10 years, but nobody ever suspected it would be this long. And I have mobility skills that far exceed my vision. They've never really been able to understand that. I just get around easier than other people do. A friend of mine once saw a file of mine that was left open at the National Eye Institute, and this would have been 10 years ago. The file note was, we don't know how he gets around without a cane or a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And this was long before I did. So I've been blessed with good mobility skills and also probably more guts than brains.
Are you afraid of the possibility of completely losing your eyesight?
It's not a question of being afraid. It's not something I certainly look forward to. It's something I can deal with better now than I could have in my youth. I remember the first time I saw someone in public use powerful magnifying lens to read something. And I thought, gosh, you know, how outlandish. That's just horrible. I hope I never have to do that. Well, now I don't think anything about it at all. And again, too, we disabled people quite often believe those negative images and myths and stereotypes. I personally looked at other people and said, you know, poor guy. I never looked at myself and said that. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem that we have now, as the baby boomers age, we're going to have problems because they believe the negative images, myths, and stereotypes. And I know two instances where when I had an intern at the White House, and then later when I was a fellow at the International Design Conference in Aspen, I had a young person approach me. Both of them had fathers who were type A personalities, very aggressive, very successful business people. They woke up one morning with macular degeneration, which is what I have. And within a year, they were legally blind, and both of them simply sit in their studies waiting for death to come. They will not get out and socialize. They will not go outside the home. They will not socialize even inside the home with former friends. And that's the kind of thing. They applied those negative images to themselves. And what's the sad thing is they both have more vision than I was born with, but they simply don't know how to use it.
What would you tell them if you could?
Get off your butts and stop feeling sorry for yourself and find out there's people on this planet who could use your help and your skills and your ability. And also there were aids and devices that could have kept you working.
Right. Well, George Covington, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
I've enjoyed it thoroughly.
George Covington is the co-author of the forthcoming book about universal design called Access by Design. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Schurach directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.